cancelling aid and agreements. One of them affects agricultural products being imported to the United States, which have generally been duty-free as a means of helping Africa. One result is that their own products are no longer being imported duty-free into the United States. So these white South African farmers who've been complaining of oppression will now actually be being hit with tariffs or regular duties. And so it's going to cost them financially, which is one of the reasons they're so upset by it and pretending that it was nothing to do with them.
Guardian reporter Chris McGreal. He was the Johannesburg correspondent for The Guardian during the last years of apartheid through 2002. We did this interview in early February. Over the past 2 months, Trump has suspended aid to South Africa, expelled the South African ambassador, and offered refugee status to white South Africans, claiming South Africa's discriminating against the white minority. Trump has also just nominated Leo Brent Bozell to be U.S. ambassador in South Africa. Bozell's son was sentenced to nearly 4 years in prison for his role in the January 6th insurrection before he was pardoned by President Trump. One note on Elon Musk's family. May Musk is Elon's mother, not his grandmother. To see part one of our interview with Chris McGreal, you can go to democracynow.org. We'll also link to his pieces. What does Elon Musk believe? And how the roots of the PayPal mafia extend to apartheid South Africa. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a big shakeup and thousands of layoffs hitting those we depend on to safeguard health. Oregon's attorney general's filing multiple lawsuits and scoring some wins against the Trump administration. And how Oregon lawmakers are responding to the nation's defense secretary text messaging classified information. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 27th, 2025. I'm Annette Newell. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the nation's Health and Human Services Secretary, just announced massive layoffs at his agency, which he has called a sprawling bureaucracy. KBOO's Josh Salem tells us more about this potentially catastrophic move.
In a major overhaul, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, or HHS, will lay off 10,000 workers and shut down a number of entire agencies. That includes ones that oversee billions of dollars in funding for addiction services and community health centers. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. criticized the department he oversees as an inefficient, sprawling bureaucracy. He also blamed the department's 82,000 workers for a decline in Americans' health. Kennedy said in a social media post, quote, "I want to promise you now that we're going to do more with less," end quote. He acknowledged that it will be a painful period for the nation's top health agencies, which are responsible for monitoring infectious diseases, inspecting foods and hospitals, and overseeing health insurance programs for nearly half the country. Overall, the department will downsize to 62,000 positions, about 75% of its former size. HHS will lose 10,000 jobs through layoffs, and another 10,000 workers who took early retirement and voluntary separation offers encouraged by Donald Trump's administration. HHS just provided a breakdown of cuts at the Food and Drug Administration, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the National Institutes of Health, and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. These include 3,500 jobs at the FDA, which inspects and sets safety standards for medications, medical devices, and foods, 2,400 jobs at the CDC, which monitors for infectious disease outbreaks worldwide, 1,200 jobs at the NIH, the world's leading public health research arm, and 300 jobs at CMS, which oversees the Affordable Care Act marketplace, Medicare, and Medicaid. HHS said it anticipates the changes will save $1.8 billion per year, but it did not provide any details about the alleged savings. The department has a $1.7 trillion annual budget, most of which is dedicated to funding Medicare and Medicaid, which are programs used by older, disabled, and poor Americans. Beyond losing workers, Kennedy said he will shut down entire agencies or fold some into a new structure, the Agency for a Healthy America. Agencies affected include the Health Resources and Services Administration, which oversees and provides funding for hundreds of community health centers around the country, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, which funds clinics and oversees a national hotline, and the Administration for Strategic Preparedness and Response, which leads the nation's medical and public health preparedness for, response to, and recovery from disasters and public health emergencies. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Oregon Governor Tina Kotek's budget does not have enough funding for recovery schools across the state, according to Oregon Live. In 2023, Oregon planned to open 9 so-called recovery schools intended to help students with addiction. The bill Kotek signed authorized funding for 3 recovery schools and allowed additional competitive grants. The new schools would have joined 3 other schools in Oregon created by the 2019 Student Success Act. But Kotek's proposed budget of $6.3 million would be only enough to fund 1 new recovery school. Sandy Stack is working to launch a recovery school in Jackson County. She says such a school will be life-saving for her community and a tremendous need, but the plan for a new Southern Oregon recovery school that she's been working on with funding partners could not go on without the help from the state. Sharon Dersey Martin runs the Lake Oswego-based Harmony Academy. She says there are at least 3 other recovery schools around the state in the planning stages that will now have to wait for funding. Recovery high schools offer standard academic courses, but add on peer support groups and other resources to help students struggling with substance issues. Many are also getting help with mental health issues. In 2023, 98 people between the ages of 15 and 24 died of overdoses, according to the latest data available from the Oregon Health Authority. As he watches the actions of the Trump administration so far, Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield believes
some of the executive orders are more bluster. We talk about, is this lightning or is this thunder?
Rayfield says during both Republican and Democratic presidencies,
one of the big roles that attorneys general have taken on in all 50 states really is a check and balance on executive power coming from the president.
And so far this time, it's been busy for the Oregon Attorney General's office.
Birthright citizenship. We had to file that lawsuit within the first 24 hours.
The first of 8 lawsuits Rayfield's filed so far is about
the 14th Amendment that says that if you're born in the United States, you are a citizen of the United States. More than 120 years interpreted that Constitution the same way, and President Trump attempted to change that interpretation with a piece of paper, an executive order, not involving Congress, not involving the states. You just can't do that.
He's also filed challenges involving funding cuts targeting Oregon's universities, health services, and food assistance.
Really important things in our communities. While holding hearings to really bring voices to these impact of these cuts, our office has filed multiple lawsuits on funding cuts across the board here in the state, and for whether it is working with OHSU and OSU, or it's the broad cuts across all different state agencies of federal funding that is coming into the state, which impact things like food assistance, health care.
At a town hall meeting Wednesday night with several Oregon state senators, he talked about what he's been seeing so far as he's fighting some of the actions of the Trump administration.
You have an amazing team of people representing you in the legislature, and they asked me to talk a little bit about what our role has been in the Attorney General's Office, Department of Justice, and fighting back against the attacks on democracy, our Constitution, our workers, gender-affirming care. There's a whole host of things that are going on right now. The unique part about the time in history that we're in right now is prior to the president taking office, he was incredibly open about the types of things he was going to do that were at odds with the Constitution, that were at odds with laws that Congress had passed, which really gave us insight in how to prepare for the eventuality when he would take office. So as attorneys general across this nation, we had already been working and preparing for what were going to be eventualities in terms of executive orders. And this is the first line of things that you start to see. And we saw that on Inauguration Day. We continue to see these being peppered, and these will continue. Some of them are a little wait and see. They're asking agencies to report back. So while in the moment it gets a big splashy headline, really what they've done is asked an agency to come back about how can we implement this later on. You have these executive orders, then it moves to administrative actions, and eventually it'll move to Congress. and some of the actions. And on these first two fronts, that's where attorneys general really start taking action. A big important role and responsibility of the Oregon Attorney General is to protect Oregon values and ensure the rule of law. To date, we have filed over 8 lawsuits against the Trump administration and the actions that they have been taking. And as a top line in that scenario, I think in 7 out of 8 of those cases, we've received not one, but multiple positive orders in each of those cases. Some of them even reaching up to the appellate courts, one of which has already reached the Supreme Court, who have really put a fine line on what the president can and cannot do. Democrats, Republicans, everyone agrees you got to follow the Constitution. If you want to change it, there's processes to change the Constitution. Do it appropriately. But when you don't, that's where you have folks like attorneys general that will hold you accountable. The funding has been nothing but chaos in a lot of the way this has been rolled out. And it has created a chilling impact on federal employment, how we're acting as a state and government and the services we're providing. Our office has filed multiple lawsuits on funding cuts across the board here in the state, while holding hearings to really bring voices to these impact of these cuts, because the president is not doing that. Normally, when you do the budget cuts, it's a public process. They're doing them in closed doors. We, as attorneys general, are holding these public hearings. We're going to be holding them in Eugene and Portland on the 9th and 10th of April. We've heard from TSA agents about the safety of our airlines, the access to our privacy with Elon Musk, right? And attempting to get private information. You have them actually taking incredible amounts of power without congressional approval or appointment. Those are a couple of lawsuits that were out there. Basically gutting the Department of Education that's going to impact vulnerable students across this country, and doing it in a matter, it's basically constructively shutting that down. We filed a lawsuit in that space and are moving in a positive way. The federal workforce and gender affirming care are 2 other lawsuits. And there's more things that are going on right now that we have our pulse on. I think the top line in this area is you have an incredible point in our democracy where the independence of our judiciary is A, be tested, B, it's being attacked, and being politicized. And right now, the results that we are seeing come back from the courts should give us a little bit of solace. So far, as we speak, we are seeing judges from a conservative bent and judges from a democratic bent. In both sides, they're exercising their independence and sticking to the rule of law. And so that's a good first place to start. And it's encouraging, but there's a lot of work to do in our office. You can always count on our office, the Oregon Attorney General's office, to make sure that we're enforcing that rule of law and our values.
That's Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield at a town hall meeting last night. He was asked if our country is in a constitutional crisis.
I tend to operate in a space of optimism and hope and where we want to be. And so I will focus on the way that the judges have been exercising their judicial independence. I think it is an incredibly dangerous moment in our history where you have the Trump administration criticizing and calling for the impeachment of judges purely because of the decisions they're making. That is incredible. But it is also incredible on the other side that the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, appointed by a Republican, is willing to come out and say that's inappropriate. So again, that's why I say we're stress testing what our Constitution, how it means, how it's interpreted. An incredible moment in time right now. And I think our judicial colleagues across the nation in those offices are taking this role incredibly serious. I have hope in those spaces. I think a lot of the orders that we have gotten from judges, some of them being long-term orders on birthright citizenship, the Trump administration is following the judges' orders. There's others that are a little bit grayer, right? And we can really start to have an argument about how they're playing fast and loose with some of these and operating in a gray area.
That was Oregon's Attorney General Dan Rayfield. And Oregon's congressional delegation members are among the many expressing outrage and demanding that the U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and others resign in the wake of what's being called Signalgate. Oregon Congresswoman Maxine Dexter had this to say.
The level of incompetence is beyond belief. We had our highest-ranking officials on our national security team having open dialogue on a commercial application that's not secure about war plans with the inclusion of an undisclosed number. Nobody cared to suggest that maybe a better channel should be used, or who's this number? The incompetence is not a joke. It put our men and women in uniforms' lives at risk. It puts our national security at absolute risk. And we are lucky no one died, but they will if we don't take action. The Senate hearings today will be revealing, I hope. And Pete Hegseth must resign.
Oregon Congresswoman Maxine Dexter and Oregon senior U.S. Senator Ron Wyden grilled several of the leaders involved in the scandal, including Tulsi Gabbard, Director of National Intelligence.
Obviously, my colleagues and I feel very strongly about the war planning meeting over unclassified phones. Obviously reckless, obviously dangerous. Both the mishandling of classified information and the deliberate destruction of federal records are potential crimes that ought to be investigated immediately. And I want to make clear that I'm of the view that there ought to be resignations, starting with the National Security Advisor and the Secretary of Defense. Director Radcliffe and Director Gabbard, have you participated in any other group chats with senior Trump administration officials in which classified information was shared using phones that weren't cleared for such information? Question for the two of you.
Senator, thank you for the question. I haven't. Your question was, have I participated in any other group chats sharing classified information? To be clear, I haven't participated in any signal group messaging that relates to any classified information at all.
Okay. Director Gabbard?
Senator, I have the same answer. I have not participated in any signal group chat or any other chat on another app that contained any classified information.
Would the two of you cooperate with an audit to confirm that is the case?
I have no objection.
Senator, I'll certainly comply with any follow-up that the National Security Council would deem appropriate. But again, to be clear, the use of signal message end-to-end encryption applications is permissible and was, in this case, used permissibly, at least to my understanding, and in a lawful manner.
The seriousness of this is so clear. That's why I want to have an audit, and both of you gave me an answer indicating that you would be open to that, and I appreciate it. Director Patel, you weren't in this particular group chat, but have you participated in any chats on unclassified phones with other administration officials relating to national security? And if so, on what other topics?
Thank you for your question, Senator, and not that I can recall.
Okay. Question I have for you, Director Gabbard, involves this question of Elon Musk wasn't going to see the military's China war plans because he said he, quote, has business in China and he would be susceptible perhaps to that. That was his comment. So as DNI, you're responsible for security clearance policies across the government. Under your watch, how are you going to go about carrying out this obligation? Because I think it obviously is a very significant one in terms of American national security.
Thank you, Senator. As the Office of the Director of National Intelligence provides oversight over these different 18 intelligence elements, leaders within those elements are empowered with that responsibility to uphold the trust that the American people have placed in them. In this example that you've cited, both Secretary Hegseth as well as President Trump completely denied the assertion that Elon Musk was going to receive any kind of classified war plan brief pertaining to China or any other country.
So on the question of whether the president has the prerogative to get clearances is really the area that I want to touch on, because you're formally responsible for security clearance policies, and that's why I'm asking about it. So can a president decide who gets a clearance?
Yes.
So what about your role? You're formally responsible for security clearance policies.
That is also true.
So how do we resolve it? President just gets his way.
The elected president and commander in chief has the authority to provide a security clearance to those who he deems necessary.
Mr. Chairman, and to the ranking member, I think we have to have a further discussion on this and figure out what the ground rules are. I think it's clear what the director says. I just think we need more clarity, because I think you have the formal responsibility for security clearances, and now we've heard that this somehow is going to be the president's project, and I think we ought to have further discussions.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio, and at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, rains likely, a low down to 48. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy with occasional light rain, a high of 54. Today in history, on this date in 1912, First Lady Helen Taft and the Viscountess Chinda, wife of the Japanese ambassador, planted two Yoshino cherry trees on the northern bank of the Potomac River near the Jefferson Memorial, commemorating Japan's gift of more than 3,000 cherry trees to the U.S. government. Our quote of the day is from A.E. Housman. "Loveliest of trees, the cherry now is hung with bloom along the bough." Heading into spring, new research looks at water conditions and impacts in the Pacific Northwest. Isabel Charlet reports on the Pacific Northwest Water Year Impacts Assessment.
An important resource for managing drought and other climate extremes was published today. The assessment tracks impacts of weather conditions on different sectors across Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. The 2024 water year, which starts and ends in the fall, was Washington's fourth warmest in more than 100 years. Higher temperatures and low snowpack contributed to drought in much of the state, according to the new data. Karen Bumbacco is a climatologist and lead author of the assessment. She says the research is helpful to understand cumulative impacts of drought on the region.
Even though our snowpack is doing better now compared to last year, that really has to be seen through the lens of deficits from the previous year and even before.
Bumbacco says that in the last decade, droughts have been more frequent than usual in Washington. The assessment focuses on impacts of either too much or too little water on seven sectors, including agriculture, drinking water, fisheries, and forestry. Bumbacco adds the agricultural sector in Washington reported the highest number of impacts from dry conditions last year.
That can range from limited water availability, reduced crop yields. There was also quite a few reports about negative consequences for livestock and grazing.
Bumbacco says heat, fire, and smoke forced recreation areas to close, and the drought brought increased insect activity and tree mortality. This is the fifth water year assessment, and Bumbacco says along with the challenges, she has noticed more people working to mitigate impacts of a changing climate.
There seems to be more climate resilience being built across our region, and people are taking action to avoid the worst impacts from either really wet conditions or really dry conditions.
For example, she says farmers are changing crops as well as the timing of irrigation and monitoring water use and availability more closely. While some areas of the state saw reduced stream flow, increasing salmon mortality, the assessment was not all bad news. Bumbacco says a well-timed August rain supported a record salmon run in North Central Washington. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
Blatant corruption in U.S. elections is legal, even though the U.S. Supreme Court pretends it's not, according to a new analysis from the Center for Economic and Policy Research. More on that from Eric Galatis.
After Elon Musk, a man once worth $327 billion, spent $250 million to elect Donald Trump, he was rewarded with unprecedented powers over the federal government. Brandon Novick with the Center for Economic and Policy Research says blatant corruption in the United States is not new, and it's legal thanks to the U.S. Supreme Court's Buckley versus Valeo ruling in 1976.
That decision was the root one that said money is speech and that people can infinitely spend in elections. In Citizens United, basically the court said, based on this, we're saying corporations, not just individuals, can infinitely spend in elections.
To avoid the appearance of quid pro quo corruption, Novick says the nation's highest court clarified that unlimited spending to influence the outcome of an election is okay, so long as the cash is spent independently and not in coordination with a candidate's official campaign. Billionaires are not just buying power from Republicans. Novick points to Reid Hoffman, who spent some $17 million to get Kamala Harris elected. When Hoffman called for the Federal Trade Commission's chair, Lina Khan, to get the boot, Harris refused to commit to keeping Khan in her post.
This issue is bipartisan. The establishments of both parties are not working to solve it. But the current Trump administration is the greatest example of that blatant billionaire control bought through bribes and campaign spending.
Good government groups have long argued that in American democracy, one citizen, not $1, should equal one vote. Novick says there are only two viable pathways to get money out of politics. The U.S. Supreme Court could overturn previous decisions, which is unlikely since many of today's justices were involved in Citizens United.
The only other way to get past this is a constitutional amendment to overturn their decision and get money out of politics. Because if Congress just passes a law, they'll strike it down.
This is Eric Galatis.
Activists say cuts to Medicaid will hurt maternity care, and cuts and changed rules at Social Security are causing customer service problems. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here is today's edition of 2025 Talks.
Though not intended to be divulged, obviously that was a mistake and that shouldn't have happened, and the White House is looking at it.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio denies that American lives were endangered by the information in a leaked Signal group chat between him and other top administration officials. But defense sources say the messages just fully published by The Atlantic show that Secretary Pete Hegseth disclosed highly classified military details before attacks on the Houthis of Yemen began, including real-time updates about the timing and the specific weapon. Regina Davis Moss of the Black Women's Reproductive Justice Group in Our Own Voice says real people will lose care if Congress makes deep Medicaid cuts.
These are real people. These are not statistics. These are lives.
The program covers more than 4 in 10 births nationally, and many struggling rural hospitals say they would close their maternity wards or go completely bankrupt without it. Black women have much higher rates of preventable deaths during childbirth. In Kentucky, doctors are calling on Governor Andy Beshear to veto an abortion bill, saying it'll complicate emergency care. Tamara Weider with Planned Parenthood says in an attempt to clarify a ban on the procedure, it will shift decision-making from the operating room to the courtroom.
The current law gives providers the authority to make decisions in emergencies, but this bill would allow judges to decide whether care was truly necessary.
According to ARP, office closings and staffing cuts mean older Americans are struggling to deal with new Social Security rules. Josh Askvig with ARP says folks who used to fix things on the phone are having a hard time meeting a new requirement for in-person or online ID verification.
Folks would have to drive 3 to 4 hours or more to get to a location, and that's a significant barrier.
I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Ashley Shingoose is identified as the first victim of the Manitoba serial killer. And 6 tribal nations withdraw from talks over Enbridge's Line 5 permit. With these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez and National Native News.
In Canada, an unknown murder victim of a Winnipeg serial killer has now been identified. More from Dan Karpinchuk.
She was known only as Buffalo Woman. Now investigators say she was Ashley Shingoose, a 31-year-old woman from the St. Teresa Point Anishinaabe Nation. Shingoose was the first victim of serial killer Jeremy Skibitzky. Officials traveled to her home community this week to break the news to her family. Investigators had searched for years to identify her. They interviewed Skibitzky in prison and found a piece of clothing in his apartment that belonged to Shingoose. DNA testing confirmed that it was hers. Officials, including Premier Wab Kanu, have pledged support for a new search of the nearby Brady landfill. Premier Kanu also addressed the people of Manitoba.
I hope that you recognize that through the ups and downs, we are moving closer to a province and to a Canada that is going to be safer, because there is going to be more trust, there's going to be more cooperation, there is going to be more shared interest for everybody, no matter where you come from in this province. And you're seeing all leaders from every level of government, including police leadership, coming forward to say this matters and we're going to work together.
The police chief, Gene Bauer, says the decision not to search for the remains of 2 of the victims had an impact on the families in the community. He said, while the past cannot be undone, we can learn and know what needs to be done. He says talks will begin soon about a humanitarian search for Shingoose's remains. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
6 Michigan tribes have withdrawn from discussions on a federal permit for the Line 5 tunnel, which the Canadian company Enbridge wants to build under the Straits of Mackinac. Interlochen Public Radio's Izzy Ross has more.
To build the pipeline tunnel, Enbridge needs a permit from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. 6 tribes in Michigan had been part of that process as cooperating agencies. That includes the Bay Mills Indian community. President Whitney Gravel says they heard last week that the Corps anticipated fast-tracking the permit under President Donald Trump's Energy Emergency Declaration. Gravel says that was the final straw in a process the tribes already thought was flawed.
What we saw time and time again is that no matter how much evidence we collected, no matter what type of comments we provided, all of that was disregarded by the Corps.
The Corps' Detroit District says it is still reviewing the tribe's letter to withdraw and that new procedures under Trump's executive order will be posted publicly. An Enbridge spokesperson said the company welcomes, quote, constructive dialogue and engagement, unquote. Line 5 carries oil and natural gas liquids from Superior, Wisconsin to Sarnia, Ontario. Right now, it runs underwater across the Straits of Mackinac in Michigan, about 4 miles along the lake bed. The underground tunnel would house a new section of the pipeline there. Debbie Chisawer is an attorney with Earth Justice, one of the nonprofit law firms representing Bay Mills. She echoed concerns about the Corps' environmental review.
One example is that the Corps interpreted the scope so narrowly that it wasn't going to consider oil spills as a potential environmental impact. And we all know that it's not a matter of if a pipeline is going to spill oil, but when.
The Corps has said assessing the risk and impact of oil spills falls outside its authority and should be handled by a different federal body. If it issues the tunnel permit, the tribes will likely challenge the decision in court. For National Native News, I'm Izzy Ross.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 27, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Lexis Ponce, Althea Billings, Isabel Charlet, and Eric Galatis. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth up next.